This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, what's up, ladies and gentlemen? You know who it is. It's your boy, Zuby. Before we get into today's episode, I have a really important announcement to make, and that is for all of my podcast listeners to know, everybody who is enjoying Real Talk with Zuby, you, the listener right now, I want you to know that you can now support this podcast on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/Zuby Music, that is Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, /Zuby Music, Z-U-B-Y Music, then you can go on there and you can make a monthly recurring donation to support the podcast. In return, you will get access to exclusive discounts, exclusive posts, videos, whole bunch of cool stuff, as well as just being part of the Team Zuby community. If you enjoy the podcast and you want to support it financially, help it to grow, expand, help us to get new guests, better sound quality, better editing, all that good stuff, all that takes financial investment. And I need your support to make that happen. So please go to patreon.com/Zuby Music and subscribe today. Without much further ado, let's get on to the podcast. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world. I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, not because it's been good to me over the past 2 years, but because it's a fascinating technology that I think is going to revolutionize the world. I'm a believer. And of course, I am talking about Bitcoin and the world of cryptocurrency. And on today's episode, we've got on a special guest. This is Stephen Cole. He is a Bitcoin investor, and he is also a consultant and an all-around Bitcoin enthusiast and crypto carnivore. So welcome to the show, Stephen. How are you doing?
Thanks, Zuby. Doing great. Happy to be here.
Awesome, man. And where in the world are you reporting from?
I'm coming to you live from Southern California around Orange County.
Awesome, man. So I've done a brief intro there, so tell the audience a little bit about you, your story, and what it is that you do.
Yeah, happy to. So I have been in the technology scene, primarily like web and internet technology, for a little over 10 years now. So background academically was computer science, and then worked in Silicon Valley for a couple large enterprises, a couple of small startup companies that were later acquired by large enterprises. So I was at eBay for a little bit. I was at Intel by way of an acquisition of a startup company that I worked for, kind of doing a combination of systems engineering, as well as kind of management and people leadership for small engineering teams there. But since about 2013, Bitcoin and economics have really had my heart. So kind of started tumbling down that rabbit hole in 2013 when I discovered Bitcoin. And although I haven't sort of worked full-time professionally in the space, it's been big passion, big thing that I love talking about, helping people figure out what this Bitcoin thing is and why it might be a big deal.
Awesome, man. So how did you discover Bitcoin? Where did you first hear about it? And when did you first get involved, and in what capacity?
Sure. What's my origin story? Let's see. So Bitcoin, was invented in 2009. I heard about it for the first time in late 2012 from a close friend, and then again from a couple of coworkers. Didn't really dip my toe in the water officially until late 2013, but just, I think it really stood out because some of the smartest people in my life, the most brilliant friends that I had, just wouldn't shut up about this thing. And I shrugged it off the first few times I heard about it. And I think that was the result of, you know, just the web industry in which we exist is all about, you know, what's the hottest app this week? And there's always something new and something new. And you kind of get fatigued with, oh, there's, you know, yet another payments app. And so the first time I heard about Bitcoin, I thought, why do we need another PayPal? And, you know, now we've got things like Venmo. Like, why do we need another way to get money from point A to point B? So unfortunately, I didn't research and dive in very much the first time I was told about it. But after seeing how enthused some very smart people in my life were, I started attending meetups, started reading more seriously about it. And then after a while of doing that, I realized, wow, this thing is actually a really big deal. And the more I read, the more of a big deal it increasingly seemed to me. I think the biggest tipping point in that was when I realized that Bitcoin isn't just a payment network. So, you know, like PayPal, Visa, and so forth, it's not just a way to get money from point A to point B. It is also potentially a new revolutionary form of money. So not just a network to transfer things, but actually units and things that are transferred on these networks. Mm-hmm. And so that side of it and those properties, which were unique and never really been seen before, totally just captured me.
Yeah, man. This is painful for me to hear because I feel like I first heard about Bitcoin around the same time. And I had those exact same, I thought it was like just some fake digital money that, you know, you could use to upgrade your like sword or buy a new gun in a video game or something, right? I thought it was just like, I didn't research it. I didn't look into the whole decentralization aspect and, you know, the fact that it's the supply is limited and all that kind of stuff that makes it what it is, you know, the main points. So it wasn't until for me, you know, like several years later that I actually did the research and jumped online, read a couple books and stuff. I don't know what spurred me to do it, but I did it and I was just like, oh my gosh, like how have I, like this whole world kind of just opened up. But I was just like, wow, like this is how have I been? I mean, I think like you said, I think maybe because you're out there in Silicon Valley, so I guess, you know, you're surrounded by a very specific type of person and type of brains, people who are like innovators and stuff. But I'd kind of been like out of that world for a while, just kind of doing my thing with music and all that. So it took several more years until I looked at it properly. But yeah, of course, it's one of those things where in hindsight, you kick yourself because you're like, oh my gosh, like had I gotten involved, like, you know, because I was sold on it quite quickly once I did the research. I only needed to research it for a few hours to be like, oh, okay, I see this appeals to me because I'm very much I'm very like libertarian minded and I'm big on like I'm big on personal sovereignty and, you know, decentralization and not, you know, people being able to have their own sovereignty, have their own power, have their own currency that's not reliant on some of these governmental and banking systems where they can kind of just do what they want, really. This is unlikely to happen in the UK, but this has happened in other countries where they're just like, okay, like tomorrow we're just gonna, the $10 notes are no longer valid. The $10 notes are no longer legal tender. Like they did that in India like a couple of years ago, right? They just said,
yeah,
oh, this rupee note is no more. Or they just keep printing money and they're just like, okay, well, we're just gonna keep printing money. And yeah, your savings are now worth 10% of what they were before, but like, yeah, just don't worry about, you know, and you're just, you see that stuff happen and you're just kind of like someone like myself, who's a little bit skeptical by nature of a lot of things. I saw that. And when I understood Bitcoin and crypto in general, I was just like, wow, okay, this is something that I think does have value, that is going to have a future, that is necessary, that does have not just one use case, but a whole bunch of potential use cases, some of which it's already doing, but you know, I think, I believe we're both around the same age and having lived through, you know, the era of seeing the way that email rose and the way that the internet rose and the way that social networking rose and how relatively quickly, you know, 20 years ago, maybe a bit more. Even like 20 years ago, the idea that everyone was going to have like a mobile phone, let alone something like a smartphone, sounded so far-fetched, right? I remember when people were first getting email addresses and people couldn't see the value in email addresses. I remember when people first were getting on social networks and people couldn't see the, what's the value of, what's the point of this, you know, like what's the point?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I think we're kind of at that stage in crypto where, you know, you've got a big number of people who are enthusiastic about it and invested and interested, but, you know, the kind of average layperson is kind of like, what's the point of this? But I've heard people say that enough times now to, you know, in 10, 15 years time, you might be using this thing day to day, whether you know it or not. So,
yeah, so true. I think we're still early. I think you and I are on the same wavelength about a lot of what you described and the potential benefits of Bitcoin, the potential value proposition, the macro environment of today. As you look around, you know, you see the levels of debt that sort of nation states have incurred and that we collectively are kind of being signed up for, whether we like it or not. You see proposals like MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, that are gaining popularity. Which essentially advocate for, you know, keep printing money and keep running large deficits and kind of putting off the inevitable long-term consequences of those things. And I'm excited about Bitcoin because I think for the first time in hundreds of years, it really gives people a practical means of opting out of that system. As an expression of maybe their discontent, of exiting, if you will. You know, the option to exit has always existed, but it's been very inconvenient in the past. So if you didn't want to participate in the economy because you either disagreed with it politically, philosophically, or just from a practical perspective, that meant things like hoarding cash or holding bars of gold under your bed or under your mattress. You know, not being able to transact electronically through these centralized systems and just big inconveniences to your day-to-day existence. And now, for the first time, Bitcoin presents this system in which you can opt out. You can say, okay, yeah, keep doing your thing. Those of you who don't think this is risky and who maybe think this is sustainable long-term, but I am going to peacefully exit and just go over here and store my wealth and my personal value in Bitcoin, in this decentralized system, which is, you know, cannot be arbitrarily inflated by central bankers. We don't have to play the game of, oh, every quarter we watch the Federal Open Markets Committee meetings to like try to guess what the interest rate's going to be and try to read between the lines of all these people speaking. We know it's monetary policy. It is set in stone. And when the supply is fixed and predictable, as Bitcoin is, then its value proposition becomes pretty compelling for storing wealth.
So there's going to be some people listening to this right now who are like, what are these guys even talking about? Like, what's this Bitcoin thing, right? So for someone who hasn't heard of it and just giving the basics, what it is, what you think the value proposition is, why they should be interested. So if you were to explain it to just the layperson, someone who's not like a techie or a computer science grad, how would you lay it out for them?
Yeah, definitely. Good to kind of step back and do the Bitcoin 101. So Bitcoin is open source software, fundamentally. So the open source words in that just mean that there are no secrets. The code for Bitcoin is available online. Anyone in the world who understands or is interested in software can go and download it and look at it and see how it works. So no secrets there. That software implements both a payment network and these units called Bitcoins, abbreviated BTC typically, that are transacted on this network. And the really interesting thing about it is that the supply and the inflation schedule for those units is fixed and known. So that was written into the original Bitcoin code. And due to a very brilliant set of kind of incentives in how this system works, it can't be changed. So there will only be a maximum of 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist in the world. So I think the immediate reaction upon hearing that from a lot of people is just, no, that can't be true. Why would digital something scarce that just like does not compute to most people? Mm-hmm. And I was the same way. I was very, very skeptical of that statement when I heard it for the first time. But after many years of kind of running through various scenarios in my head and reading, learning, seeing things in the community, I am increasingly convinced that yes, it is true. And it's the first time that we've really achieved scarcity in the digital asset realm. In my opinion, that's really the big breakthrough of Satoshi Nakamoto, the person or group of people who invented Bitcoin. You'll often hear it phrased by, you know, computer science geeks as Satoshi solved the double spend problem, which is true, but I think it's more intuitive for people if you frame it as Satoshi solved the problem of digital scarcity. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of think about the internet that we've all known for most of our lives, it's been this internet of digital assets, but abundant digital assets. So if you have a digital asset like a picture on your cell phone or an MP3 file on your laptop, then you can send those around to other people. And as you visit websites, you know, you're kind of retrieving those types of objects from other entities, maybe Google, maybe Facebook. But that's not really a transaction. It's not really like a bearer asset in that I have this picture and then I'm going to send it to you. And because I sent it to you, it's no longer with me. Like, it's no longer mine. And Bitcoin is the first time that there has been a scarce digital asset where that scarcity hasn't required a central party to kind of, you know, mimic or enforce scarcity. It's just inherently scarce.
Here's a question that I've found that people tend to ask is, if there's only 21 million, people don't understand how that works. They're like, well, there's 7.5 billion people in the world. There's not enough for everybody. So,
yeah, totally. So the one important aspect of it to understand is that although there are a max of 21 million Bitcoin, each Bitcoin can be sliced up very granularly. So it is possible to send up to 1/100 millionth of a Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network, and potentially even smaller units if you really needed to, using kind of higher layer solutions at some point. But the short answer there is there's enough to go around, although the supply is fixed. So if you do the math on that, like 1/100 millionth of a Bitcoin actually makes it possible to send value in even smaller amounts than we've technically been able to. So you can send a fraction of a penny to someone using Bitcoin. Mm. And that isn't even possible in the, you know, traditional financial system. So if you try to send a nickel to someone around the world using PayPal or Visa, that's not going to fly. Like, it just gets eaten away in fees. There's too much overhead and so forth. So it also, if these, you know, micropayment use cases can come to fruition, it unlocks some pretty exciting use cases there too, around, like, now that we have the ability to send money in such small amounts, what does that enable us to do? What, like, could the internet be almost fueled by Bitcoin? Would it be more efficient if, rather than a complex system of intermediaries and advertisers, if content creators could just get compensated directly for consumers via Bitcoin? If you stream a video or a song from your system, or if YouTube streams videos to people, maybe they pay per megabyte or per second or whatever the time frame is. Maybe they pay in Bitcoin. And
at the moment, that's something like what Basic Attention Token is doing. So with the Brave browser, I've seen
that. Yeah.
I've got that actually installed on my YouTube channel and my website. So
nice. Yeah, I run the Brave browser too. I'm a big fan of.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'd heard about it several years ago, and I used the first, like, the beta version of it way back, but it was missing too many things for it to replace Chrome as my main browser. But now that it's stepped up a lot, I've started using it. So I think it's pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, I agree. It's come a long way recently. And that would be a good, for any listeners who aren't familiar with Brave, that might be a neat thing to check out. So they're a web browser based on Google Chrome. They're compatible now, luckily, with all of the, you know, or most of the popular Chrome extensions, and very focused on privacy and anonymity. So a lot of features to help guarantee that, help kind of block ads by default and make your web browsing experience better. But they're also doing it in a pretty thoughtful way. So there are a lot of ad blockers out there that just kind of block ads and that's the end of it. But their vision is, you know, block ads by default, but still have a long-term plan and strategy for how to ultimately compensate content creators who, you know, need to be compensated for what they're doing in order to kind of fund what they do. So,
yeah. Awesome, man. So do you consider yourself, are you a Bitcoin maximalist, or do you think that there is room for other cryptocurrencies? At the moment, there's about 2,000 or so out there. Obviously, Bitcoin is the best known one. It's the king, but there's another 1,000 and several hundred out there. So what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. I do describe myself as a Bitcoin maximalist. That term comes with a lot of baggage. So on, you know, Twitter, there are, if you call yourself a maximalist, then people make a lot of assumptions about how much you hate altcoins and that, like, if, you know, that I just like don't talk to or associate with anybody if I find out that they own Ethereum.
It gets political, man. Crypto gets political.
Absolutely. I like to think that I'm kind of a down-to-earth, open-minded maximalist. So I consider myself a pretty practical maximalist in that I'm not, you know, I don't like worship at an altar of Satoshi. I don't think Bitcoin is the one for just like, for, you know, zealous reasons. I really think Bitcoin is going to dominate, but I think it's going to do that for very practical reasons. It's got the largest market cap. It has the most liquidity. I think it has the highest developer and technical talent in the space. And I think if any other coins do offer significant differentiation, then, you know, I almost view altcoins as sort of like feature requests for Bitcoin. Like if an altcoin really, really saw strong adoption and it seemed to be a big threat to Bitcoin, then that is an opportunity. That's a free market experiment. And Bitcoiners can look at that and go, okay, why is that, like, is this a threat? Or is this doing something interesting and useful? And if so, is there something that we can incorporate into Bitcoin as a result of that? And so long-term, if I had to hold any digital asset and I could only hold one, absolutely 100% Bitcoin. I think the others range from interesting technical experiments that I respect to just, you know, flat out scams on the far end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that a good 95% to 98%, I think it would be fair to say, are like junk, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree 100%.
I think most of the ones in the top 30 out of push, you know, top 100, 150, I think not every single one, but I think that there are a lot of projects in there that are doing interesting stuff in various arenas. You know, some of them are trying to compete with Bitcoin as a currency, whereas other ones are, you know, more like decentralized platforms or taking something that already exists and moving it onto a blockchain. So I think there are quite a few interesting projects there. I'm kind of like I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist myself. Maybe I'll become one as it seems like as people stay in the space longer, they tend to move in that direction. But I'm kind of like a majority Bitcoin position. And then dabble in some other stuff that I think is cool and is going to have some legs and longevity.
Yeah. And my journey through Bitcoin definitely had a lot of altcoins in it. So, you know, I wasn't always a Bitcoin maximalist. I think it's pretty natural when you first discover the space to probably hear about Bitcoin first, since it is the largest and first. But then you think, okay, well, you know, what is the next thing? Like, what is Bitcoin 2.0? We're kind of conditioned through rapid iteration in the internet and in apps, going back to what we were talking earlier, to kind of always be looking for the next thing. And so naturally, like when I started, I was like, oh, Bitcoin's neat. There's this Litecoin thing. It seems pretty similar. It's cheaper. I kind of convinced myself at the time. Yeah. But over time, after dabbling in altcoins, learning more about them, and being hands-on with quite a few, I have done a 180 and have come back to, you know, believing most strong, like Bitcoin being the only coin that I have long-term confidence in. And that's a pretty common path from what I've observed over the years in Bitcoin, seeing people enter the space, maybe get some skin in the game with Bitcoin, go big into altcoins, and then kind of walk that back over the years.
That's interesting, man. So how do you see the next, where do you see the future going for it? So obviously you are a long-term, long vision investor in this space. So why, right? There are people who don't get it. The majority of people don't own any Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency. There are lots of people who are aware of it, but they still don't own any, and they don't really get like, why are some people so evangelical about this? Or they're looking at the last market where the price took a 75-80% hit, and they're like, whoa, no, that's crazy. Like, I can't get involved in that. That looks like a scam. That looks like a bubble. So I'm sure you've heard it all more than I would have, because you've been in the space for 5 to 6 years now. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Like, where does your long-term bullishness on Bitcoin come from?
Yeah, I think my long-term bullishness, and I am ultra bullish long-term, comes from looking at Bitcoin's strength as money and its monetary properties. And what scares a lot of people away, as you mentioned, is the volatility. So if you look at price charts of Bitcoin since, say, 2010 or 2011, and this is actually one of my favorite exercises to do at meetups when I speak to people, is I show a graph of the Bitcoin price starting around 2011 and then up through the most recent kind of bubble and downfall to where we are today. And I say, all right, where is the big scary crash? And everybody points to, you know, the far right of that graph where you see the run up in 2017 and then the fall earlier this year. But actually, the big scary bubble could just as rightly be pointed at late 2013 when it crashed from, you know, $1,000 down, I think, like 70%. And what happens is the next big run up makes the big run up prior to that look tiny. That one in 2013, if you were to just zoom in on that, there would be a crash from a couple of years before.
I'm getting excited. I'm ready.
Right.
I'm ready. I've just had pain for 2 years. I'm ready.
I'm gonna give you a dose of hopium here. Don't worry. So psychologically, we're not used to that, and we're not conditioned for that. And it's a function of Bitcoin's scarcity, right? Because the market cannot print more to kind of like, as the value goes up in an asset, there's a big incentive in the creators of that asset to make more to sell and kind of enrich themselves. But with Bitcoin, the supply is fixed, and also the rate of creation is fixed. So no matter, you know, if Bitcoin goes today, as we're recording this, it's about $5,300. If it were to skyrocket to $1 million by tomorrow, there is no way for more miners to go and kind of mine more of this stuff, because Bitcoin's algorithm that determines how many are created adapts to that in order to ensure that they're created at this predictable rate. So unlike, you know, if the value of silver went to $1 million overnight, then investors would go out, they would buy a bunch more equipment to mine silver, and they would go exploring because there's this huge bounty on creating more. Or they would like try to fly rockets to asteroids and like get a bunch of silver off there, which also will be a thing out there. So with Bitcoin, the scarcity is far more perfect and known than even some of the assets that have been viewed as safe haven assets and attractive for those reasons, like gold.
Yeah.
So I was a big fan of, you know, gold, and still am to some degree, but I think Bitcoin has all of its strengths plus more, plus transportability and immutability. So long term, I see the phase that we're in right now as a very volatile and speculative one. I would recommend to anyone thinking about investing in Bitcoin to brace for volatility and accept it as inevitable. There are a lot of people who say, oh, well, you know, I'll wait to kind of get my skin in the game, but I want it to settle down first. And I don't think it's going to be settling down anytime soon. It's if you look at actually how new money kind of comes into existence and is adopted, it typically happens in these four phases. So first, it's this collectible item with no monetary value. And then in subsequent phase, it's sort of this speculative store of value phase, where it has a market price and people, you know, invest in it to store their wealth there, but it's not necessarily used to list prices or to transact very heavily. And then only after that highly speculative store of value phase do you really enter phases in which using it as a medium of exchange day to day for payments, or especially as a unit of account to like list prices in as a merchant, only after those phases do those things become practical at all.
Yeah. And I know you're not, you're obviously not able to predict the future, but if you were to try to estimate, how long do you think that speculative phase that we're currently in, how long do you think that's going to last? How long do you think it'll be until there's a, you know, I don't know what level of adoption would be needed to stable it out, but how far in the future are you, are we talking? Are we talking decades? Are we talking, you know, how long do you think it might take for that level to be reached?
It's hard to say. I'd say we're going to take at least 10, 15 years to do it, probably more, but that doesn't mean that it would need, I think even before we get to the end of that phase, we will see huge unprecedented increases in price. Because we do really, and again, you know, not investment advice, not financial advice for anyone listening, all the usual disclaimers. Yeah. But I, as someone with skin in the game and strong belief in this, you know, I do think that we will see, right now, Bitcoin's market cap is somewhere near $100 billion. Sounds like a big number, but if you look at that relative to other asset classes with which Bitcoin competes, it's a drop in the bucket. So the value of gold in the world, estimated above ground gold, is about $7 trillion. So, you know, $100 billion versus $7 trillion. Let's say Bitcoin failed miserably at any of the micropayment use cases that seem promising, at any of the like low latency, buy your coffee type of transactions. I think it's going to succeed for that. But let's just hypothetically say it does not. Let's say all it does well is digital store value gold. That is still a huge market potential, going from a market cap of $100 billion to $7 trillion potentially, stealing that from gold. So I think it's going to do all that and a lot more.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm feeling a bit better. I've got some hopium now. It's been anyone who's not invested, it's been a very rough year and a half. It's been a very rough year and a half now for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general. The market peaked late 2017, early 2018, and then since then it's taken a beating to the tune of $700 billion in terms of market cap, which
yep.
I know is not a strict exact measure, but that's like 80%, 85% drop from where it was at its peak. So yeah, so you know we're still here, we're still optimistic. But yeah, it's been a rough ride.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do during these types of bear markets, and you're right, it has been a rough ride. With each cycle like this that you see, it gets a little bit easier, I think, to weather the storm psychologically. And one thing I like to do during times like this is just flip back and read headlines from mainstream media during the previous crashes. And there are things along the lines of, you know, so there's a great site out there actually called Bitcoin Obituaries, where they're collecting these. And yeah. So I would recommend everybody go and check that out if you want some historical perspective. But inevitably, every time there's some huge dip in price, you'll just get these Bitcoin is dead headlines, RIP Bitcoin, I guess it's time to move on. You know, there are headlines from Forbes back when Bitcoin was $15 that say things along those lines.
You know,
this Bitcoin thing's dead. Everybody move on. It's over. and I think, you know, maybe in the future, we will be here while Bitcoin is $100,000, having just crashed from $500,000, and we'll be talking about how dead it is. And that's just how this goes.
it's funny, man. But yeah, no, I've got my long term vision goggles on for this, because yeah, it's because as far as I'm concerned, the reason why I bought in the first place, the fundamentals haven't changed. Well, they've improved, if anything. They've improved. To be honest, it's the bear market's gone on for over a year now, so it's gotten to the stage where I'm not bothered. Like when it was happening, like early 2018, I was, man, that was rough. Like I'm not a super emotional person, but I had some time. I was looking at the thing. It was just dropping and dropping and I was just like, holy crap. Like it must stop. Oh, yeah. And it didn't stop. It just kept, it just kept going. It got to a point where I was like, okay, you know what? Like, I'm just going to see the funny side of this, right? Like I'm not going to make any stupid move. I'm just going to like, it's gotten to the stage where someone asked me about it and I kind of just smile and like chuckle. Cause I'm like, yeah. On one hand, I'm like super optimistic long-term, but in the short term, I'm kind of like, yeah, like that was, I got a bit
over-exuberant. T-shirt.
Yeah.
I have a t-shirt and a sticker on my laptop with my preferred strategy for these types of bear markets. And it's a picture of an astronaut meditating with a Bitcoin moon in the background. And I think that is the approach that I strive for in this, is just to kind of be zen and remind myself that this is how it goes. Volatility is inevitable. And certainly, like, you know, maybe I'm wrong about this Bitcoin thing. I would recommend anyone thinking about getting into this, only invest what you can afford to lose. So I do go through the mental exercise of, if this thing went to $0, how would I feel about my life and all of that? And as long as the answer is, you know, you'd still feel good, then I think you're invested to a healthy extent.
Yeah.
But I do believe in it, not only for monetary gains, but because philosophically, I believe it would be a better world if we had a Bitcoin standard for money.
Yeah. So in your mind, what's the best case scenario and what's the worst case scenario? And how could either of those unfold?
For price or for sort of like world implications with this Bitcoin stuff?
Let's say both. So you talked about it potentially going to zero. I mean, do you think that's possible? And how would that realistically occur? Like, I mean, I can't think of how it would go to zero. I can think of it how it could go pretty low, but I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. And I love that, you know, just kind of the thinking about, seeing people think about, could it go to zero? And how could that happen? Because if you rewind a few years, that was not a crazy idea at all. It was like, yes, of course this Bitcoin thing could go to zero.
Yeah.
And while it is still a possibility, every year that it continues to exist and to be immutable and to do what it's doing, that idea just becomes increasingly crazy. And so I would say, yeah, of course, zero is the worst case, very slim possibility of that occurring. As far as whether the bottom is in yet, I do actually think the price bottom is in now. And like as of the last few weeks, we've seen a pretty strong reversal. I could be wrong. I'm not a very good short-term trader. So, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if we saw something down to the 2000s. But I do think that the short-term price bottom is in, and that hopefully the beginning of at least an accumulation phase, if not a kind of subsequent bull run, has begun. In terms of the long-term implications, I will give a plug to one of my three favorite books in the world. So there's a book called The Sovereign Individual that a lot of people in the Bitcoin community have read and talked quite a bit about. And I'd highly recommend it to readers. It was written by a couple of British political scientists. And it was written back in 1997, which is, you know, well before Bitcoin, but even before the internet was nearly as big of a deal as it is today. And they make some bold predictions about the impact of technology, especially communications technology, on society. And they kind of, you know, classify our evolution into these ages. And so you had like the hunter-gatherer age, and they talk about the dominant institution of each age. So in the age of hunter-gatherers, the dominant institution was like the physically strongest individual in the tribe, or the physical strongest tribe in a collection of tribes. And then you fast forward to the age that we've all existed in for most of our lives, the industrial age, and the dominant institution of our age is the nation state, so US government, UK government, and so forth. And prior to that, it was really the church. So like going back to, before the sort of 1400s, 1500s, the church really ruled everything about life. So even education, schooling, and so forth. And they discuss the transition from the industrial age that we've existed in for most of our lives to the next age of human evolution, the information age. And they actually use the fall of the Berlin Wall as kind of a milestone indicator of when this really began. And the start of this is kind of with the decentralization of technology. So the advent of the microprocessor and then the internet, which further broke the monopoly on communications that the printing press started to break hundreds of years ago. And they predict in this book back in 1997 that after we've kind of unlocked communication from those monopolies, then at some point we will unlock money from those monopolies. We will take money out of the hands of these central institutions and bankers. And the long-term implications for how society is organized when that happens get pretty wild and pretty fascinating. And they theorize that the dominant institution of the information age will be the individual. So an individual being as powerful as a nation state has historically been, or more powerful, because nation states no longer have the ability to enforce taxes or to seize the wealth of people who have created wealth. So if you have, even safe haven assets like bars of gold, historically, those have been great in certain ways, but it's been difficult to transport them or to flee with them. So if people really wanted to steal your wealth, they could come and, kick down your door and, with weapons and take gold that you physically have stored or money that you physically have stored. Or if you were being displaced as, say, a refugee, then you would often have to leave behind a lot of your wealth. And with Bitcoin, that's no longer true. So it really, with Bitcoin, you can even go so far as to store your Bitcoin in your brain, which I know sounds a little wild and listeners might be thinking, what in the world does that mean? but you can essentially memorize a phrase of words, like a secret password. And that anyone in the world who knows those words would be able to spend your Bitcoin. But unless you voluntarily give that to someone else, then they cannot steal your wealth. And if you were the only one who knew that password and you expired, then those Bitcoin would be forever unspendable. And that kind of changes the logic of violence and the means of extracting wealth from people that nation states have enjoyed for the last few hundred years. And so I think a lot of the scary seeming, large scale wars, things that that we've seen in the world that have been, in my opinion, mostly bad, a little bit of good, but mostly bad. I think Bitcoin represents the potential for a positive change in a very different direction.
That sounds good. I think everybody can get on board with that.
Now, so, would not be a perfect world, would not be a utopia, but I think would be an improvement over what we've got today.
Every attempt for a utopia has ended in dystopia, so I'm quite happy. a lot in the 20th century, a lot of people try to bring utopia, and the results were not good. So I'm quite happy with the world being imperfect. We can make it better, but anytime someone starts talking utopia, I get worried.
I hear you.
Yeah, man.
I think we share that natural skepticism.
Yeah. So what's next for you? What are you working on at the moment, or what do you have planned for your future? Do you want to continue to? Is your goal to spread the word about Bitcoin to more people, or to develop stuff on the blockchain, or how do you see yourself fitting into the space in terms of what you're doing now and what you want to do in the future?
Yeah, definitely. That's a question that I've been asking myself a lot over the last few years. So Bitcoin has always been a passion of mine. I actually took a sabbatical between work at startups to travel the world for 6 months, kind of backpack around the world. And a big theme of that trip was speaking to people, helping the average person understand what this Bitcoin thing is, why I think it's a huge deal, how they might be able to benefit from it. So I do, you know, I'm not a prolific speaker like the Andreas Antonopoulos's of the world. And a little plug for Andreas, he's an awesome Bitcoin author and speaker. I'd highly recommend anyone listening check out his material as well. I have done things historically on a smaller scale, so kind of meetups, small businesses. I still do consult both for kind of Bitcoin education for retail investors, as well as institutions, so venture capital firms, family offices. I also still do web engineering. Like, I'm a tech nerd at heart, and I like cloud computing infrastructure. That's been most of my professional background. So I still do a lot of that day to day, and am very interested in investing in tech. I think investing in general, I've gained a huge appreciation for after Bitcoin got me thinking more about kind of, you know, money, time, investing, how you spend your hours in the day, and how you spend your wealth. So have been getting a little bit more into the finance realm recently as well, and dabbling in kind of small scale startup investing in modest investments in seed stage companies, a couple in the Bitcoin space, a couple in other kind of non-Bitcoin specific spaces too.
Awesome.
So
that's awesome, man.
Yeah, but I'll tell you two things for sure. I will be tweeting and I will be hodling.
Well, if you're going to be tweeting, where can people find you?
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. Twitter also is by far the best source for kind of day-to-day Bitcoin information. It's what brought me to learning about Bitcoin is what brought me to Twitter. And it's great for that. I'm on there. My Twitter username is sthenc, sthenc. So give me a follow if this is the kind of stuff you're interested in.
Awesome. Stephen Cole, man. So good to talk to you, dude. And we will definitely talk again in the future. Until then, we will both keep tweeting. We will keep hodling. And we'll keep spreading the word and spreading that hopium.
Sounds like a plan. Great to chat, Zuby. I appreciate it.
All good, man. This is Real Talk with Zuby. Thank you for tuning in. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like a bang, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.